I think it's even more than politicians. There was a whole effective altruism movement. Where are my dollars going, and what's my return on that investment? And historically, the arts have not been very good about quantifying that in a way that someone who's very analytically minded would say, that's a good investment to make.
But, you know, like when we were going through this thing in the 90s around the NEA debate, it was very clear around institutions that did keep record, right? The museums, the symphonies. There were more people at that time that were attending museums than were going to football games, right? Now, you would not believe that to be true because every Sunday you see the crowds, right? But over the course of, you know, the published data at that time was that, you know, the arts were outpacing agriculture and they were outpacing sports. So you can make those cases, you know, but you're right, Kate, you have to have the data in front of you.
I think it was a social change that grew out of technology. I mean,
so the comment up here was that the social dynamic change that grew out of technology, that you think people were going out less or in general, or
it's where they put their energy and their money changed, where their soul.
So where they put their money and energy, and where they their soul somehow. Sorry, I'm just repeating for those folks in the back.
You know, like I noticed because I was living in San Francisco, there was change in a personality, and this was during the 90s. We changed in the personality of the culture. Like, people drove different. I mean, they weren't nice at four-way stops. I mean, that was one of my sins, because nobody let you go. And it was like, and I was selling real estate, and my client face were more techies, and I noticed that they were like totally different human beings. I mean, that's kind of a
so can't we can't yeah, no it is it, it that I think that's a good theme that's come up though, is that technology, the culture of technology shifted. There was something seismic about how it shifted our culture. We can't really put our finger on it. Go ahead.
No, I wanted to fuck.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Well, no, that's pretty much it. I felt like there was personal change in the way people lived their lives, like the next generation
was very ambitious,
and I don't think they necessarily felt like the arts were valued.
Well, but if I might just get to it, that part of how I think that happened is because this austerity process that happened during the 1980s. Of practicalizing everything that had to do with education and life. First of all, that if you're not working hard, if you're not picking yourself up by your bootstraps, that's your problem, because everything is possible in America. And therefore, when you go to school, you need to buckle down and let there be 1,000 points of light that make it possible for you to deal with the three R's. Well, when you try to quantify madness, which is what art is, you can't do it like that. I remember when I first started teaching at the Art Institute, and even at CCA, and my syllabus was an outlier that was quite vague. And the reason you wanted it to be vague was because you had to have room for weird people who didn't fit into any category. And if you were teaching at a school like Art Institute, weirdness was the modality. And therefore, when you wound up doing a lecture or you couldn't quantify shit. So what happened is in the 80s, Ronald Reagan, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say the person, but in the 80s, it became necessary to put together a lesson plan that had objectives and that they could be recorded and that it was important for you to have statistical breakdowns that went toward your accreditation. And that meant that the weirdness that had animated the school got restricted through the sense of, okay, I got to find out, how do the students feel about me? And then secondly, I have to have quantifiable data to let people see that the outcomes are measurable. Now, how do you say, okay, this crazy person who put, I'm sorry, but sanitary objects around their body and rolled down the street, and it was a profound performance. But how do you tell Ronald Reagan, I'm sorry, how do you tell the quantifiable data that that was a profound experience in relationship to how the society operates through a developing feminist consciousness in the arts? That, it don't happen. So my point is that it slowed down this notion that art could be driven by passion and weirdness. And when people came into the world, they didn't have the same passion for the arts that the previous generation had. And of course, they're not going to spend their money on things that are not quantifiable in that way. That's my sense of it.
That's an interesting tension between Kate's comments about showing data that and weirdness as the modality. You know, that's hard. That's a hard circle to square.
It's not, though, because they go to different ends. In the educational world, it needs to have the freedom that Dewey's describing, right? It has to. You know, in the political world, it's the opposite, right? They need to see the values in different ways, right? So, you know, ticket prices are one of the ways they do that. You know, attendance is one of the ways they do that.
Question or comments?
So I'm seeing kind of the same thing happen with the entire Burning Well bit. I started going in 1993, and it was just a desert with a bunch of us idiots, may peace, you know, burning it because of both the hell, and there were no fesses, there were no bros, there were no etiquette. Then as it developed, and it started gaining steam, and they were all building these big pieces. I was an early grant person, and in the beginning, you know, you got these grants, and good God, you always chilled yourself, but all your friends helped, and you didn't take any more money, and you just pulled it out of repertoires, right? And then as tech money began to come in, it changed everything. I'll never forget when plug and play started happening. I was like, wait, actual self-reliance. You know, all of a sudden, we could, the work that was all kind of raw and janky and fun and sexy, he aimed clean and tight, and the money went up, the grants went up, but they said, oh, now you get this, and you have to raise another $50,000 from all of your friends. And more, it became more rules, more money, more influence. So I saw it after 17 years. I did 93 to 2010. But, you know, more and more, everything is money and is show. And so it's influencers out there, TikTok-y, not people actually making work with the dirt, which it was. And so I see a parallel in that and what's happening to the arts. You know, IBL, big tech, values, creativity in the same way.
Okay. So I think that's kind of a major theme and tension that got us here. Where's here? What's going on now? Emily, I want to start with you. What's the status? And and if you want to jump into some of your work with Patreon and some of the work with the
nonprofit, well, it's a nice like tie-in.
What dynamics are you seeing? What challenges? With what hopes today?
I took to cut back a little bit. So I have a dear friend who was in his 80s. Some of you might know the same as Ron Turner. He started Last Gas Comics in the late 60s, and I remember. I'm still working in nonprofits, you know, tech was booming, real estate was really expensive. I was not making enough to really live here, but doing it anyway. And I asked him what he thought. And he said, you know, everyone has this fixed point of San Francisco in their mind, that you come in at a certain place and you think about what you've experienced and you want that to stay. But the city has never been like that. And it never will be like that. And I don't want to hold on to it like that. And it really changed the way I think about things. And so to layer that onto where I am now, where I spent 20 years in nonprofits and now work in tech, where I do work with a lot of very creative people. And I think that the argument is that when things that used to be weird now become mundane, it is up to creative people to bring that weird back. And I think that can happen in a lot of different industries. I know lots of software engineers who are creative people and artists, and they use a left brain, right brain that I don't quite understand to do that. But I think it's easy for us to say that tech was the problem. And in some ways, the rise of tech in the Bay Area really contributed to that. And I also think that there has not really been a harnessing of that for today in ways that we could really leverage. The fact that everyone who moves to the Bay Area, just San Francisco, I also speak for San Francisco because I lived and worked in San Francisco for 25 years, but there is a weird there that embodies the city that drew me in and draws a lot of people in, regardless of whether or not you're a maker or not. And I think that today that still exists, and I believe it will continue to exist no matter the ups and downs that we experience. And from my perspective of today, it is harder to find unless you are already connected to it, but it still exists.
And tell me, and give a little familiarity, you know, Patreon, you're trying to create a platform for artists to connect directly through a community, right? So you got Griff over there who's running a gallery. He's trying to bring people to a specific place. He's that main point. Patreon, where
Patreon is a very digital world. It is a software platform where creative people can monetize their work, whether that's through monthly payments or one-off payments. They build online communities where I do see very real relationships get created and maintained that sometimes move offline, but it is very specifically virtual.
So it's trying to distribute the value. So instead of one person having to pay $5,000 for a painting, you're trying to get a community of 5,000 people to support this artist on an ongoing basis.
You know, there are people making tens of thousands of dollars a month on $5 increments, much like the way politicians started to raise money, you know, in small donations. That idea of my full-time job may not need to pay me the salary anymore because I can build a community of people who can sustain my work with small donations. Small monetary amounts that they get some benefit from, some value, whether that's tangible or not.
The thing about the difference between this and what we're sort of talking about, though, with respect to the place, this place,
yeah,
right, is that the online world is distinctly no place, right? It's nomadic. It's for wherever you happen to be. The specific problems for us here are very much related to the cost of living here, right? So young people, despite whether they're gamers or their artists, are struggling with the reality of, like, how do you keep up with the greed component of real estate prices? It's shocking, right? And so the truth of it is that artists have always decamped for some other place that's cheaper. You know, it was Portland, it was Los Angeles, it was Texas, it was, you know, wherever. And I think that the takeaway in one respect for me is that that's okay. Like, if it's not here, maybe that's okay. Like, as long as it exists in a place where people can, you know, Tucker Nichols had this great line where he was talking about this and was saying, look, as long as there's a place where people can show up without a plan.
Yeah.
You know, and figure it out, because that's what we all did, right? We all came here not so much with the idea that we were going to get rich in the industry. We were trying to find our people.
So you give me your take on what's happening now, and, you know, it could be for you too. So you closed down Gallery 16. What do you see in the landscape now? What are opportunities?
We shut down Gallery 16 because we got priced out of that space.
Okay.
Right? We had been there for 25 years. The rent was going to suddenly go to $35,000 a month.
Got it.
Right? So it's not a question mark. It's just a reality. And so the point is that
how does a creative community exist in a place that has to pay $35,000 a month? And you know the scene
anywhere.
Well, like a lot of the other major galleries went under. There was
six or seven of us that closed within 3 or 4 months of each other.
So that's right now. What
I mean, Rena Breaskin closed, you know, she'd been there for 60 years.
Yeah.
Twice as long as I had. You know, I thought 33 years was a long time to put into the business. And Altman Siegel and Jack Fisher and Rena Branston, I mean, you go through the list. Contemporary Jewish Museum, DeRosa has been having its struggles. We want to support these places while they're still here and not bemoan the loss of them, right? And so it's important that we're all rallying. You know, I like the fact that we're doing it here today. To be able to kind of remind ourselves that this is a gem. I will say this just as an aside. One of the things that we can learn from history is the way in which a wealthy patron like Rene DeRosa built this collection and built a community operation here was based on the idea that he was following his own whim, right? He didn't have art consultants and interior designers explaining to him what he was going to need to buy. He went out and he made friends with the artists. He invited them back to the preserve. Those folks oftentimes became part of the collection. The collection is, by lots of standards, odd, right? But it's odd in the best way. It's a representative of the weirdness of this place, right? The Bay Area was not New York. And Rene DeRosa's following his own nose, like he built a collection that was distinctly his. And that's what we should be telling everybody to do, right? Is to find their own weirdness, right? Find their own, the thing that turns them on and support it with their actual resources. So I think there is a real gift in a historical reminder of what the best of this place was. And it was people like him going out and engaging people that, you know, whose parents probably thought they were lost causes.
Dewey, what's going on these days? What do you see? What dynamics? What challenges?
How's your career ball these days?
Well, I'm, you know.
Because you were, and you were.
I'm just in the studio. I don't know what's going on.
Man, you have antenna though, man. You have cosmic antenna going.
That's true.
Well, first of all, I'm learning so much as I always did from you guys. So it's helping me. But my point is, I think makers make, no matter what's in the world, no matter what the conditions, makers will do what they have done from the moment they spit their impression on a wall in a cave 27,000 years ago. So I don't have any concern for whether artists will do what they do, or makers, as I prefer to call them, no matter what kind of making they do. I just think that the creative impulse needs passionate bringers. And when I say bringers, I mean people like this who have passion. This, you could see the passion that the person who put this together, you could see the passion in their environment. You could see them expressed in the way the pathways come to this location. So when you have freaky people like that, who have to bring into the world something that can stimulate the mundane, the everyday, and I should say that, you know, I recently had a grandson, and before he could actually speak, he was opening up my Android and moving his hand immediately without even somebody telling him and making this stuff flicker. Now, that is probably where many makers will be in that space, wherever that space is. It's not the space that I can deal with, but who am I to articulate to him that's not that surface? See, I do lament that he can't feel this. See, this piece of paper, this rustling, this sound that makes, he may not be animated by that, because that surface, when children first experience it, will help to shape the way they experience the world. And for me, that's a loss, because the actual tactility of you is deeply necessary. But we have a generation that may come and they can only perceive you through a goggle. And we don't know what that's going to bring, but I'm not going to down it, because makers they're just freaky, and they will find a way to make that meaning in that. So I don't really have, I think we're in a great space. Like, no matter how crazy this moment is, and it's crazy, people, human beings, they're going to bring dynamism to it. It's you, if you're a creative, you can't live in a box in a culture like this. So, you know, I'm just waiting until I'm, you know, a molecule again.
All right. That's a perfect segue. This is the, you know,
you see why Mitch and I were inspiring in his classroom. You understand this?
I mean, just seeing my daughter's font and Dewey's voice contrasted is my favorite contrast, favorite tension in the room. So crystal ball, like Dewey's talking about surface. We thought that people looked inside the crystal ball, but how the crystal ball was used is to look at the surface and see how light and texture was bent across that surface as a way of prognosticating to the future. Give me your future. Give me your crystal ball. What are you seeing these days? Whether it's organizations or people or galleries or efforts that you're seeing online that you think are breadcrumbs into the future.
I mean, there's always the young people that are starting something in their garage, right?
Yep.
I bought a tiny little piece out of a gallery called Personal Space in Vallejo. There's little treasures all over the place, but you got to work to find them. You know, it's not going to be the difficulty for young people starting out trying to make work or present work or start a band is to try to get people to pay attention to what they're doing, right? And so if you have this inclination to support the local arts communities, find those places.
Okay. Emily, crystal ball time.
I think we'll continue to see people using those virtual spaces. My niece did the same thing, by the way. I tried to swipe the TV before she could talk. It was wild. But I have a friend making VR spaces for trans and non-binary to create their own spaces. Like, I think we'll continue to see artists pushing the boundaries of digital spaces while also, I think, and this is also years past post-pandemic, but everyone was so removed from being in real life that there is now more of a trend back to coming together in places and having conversations. So I'm happy to say that I think we'll see both.
Crystal ball?
Oh, I thought we did.
Yeah, you do. All right. So it's interesting that you say that, because we didn't recover from the pandemic culturally. We thought we did. So Root Division looked at its attendance. We like, oh, this is our attendance before the pandemic, and this is our attendance after. Oh, we'll bounce back. We've been 6 years rude, you know, thinking that we were going to bounce back. We didn't. Those patterns have definitely changed. And Griff, you and I talked about collaboration, because, you know, our space, people don't want to come to our space, and we have to collaborate with other organizations that are in other spaces throughout San Francisco and Bay Area in order to attract more people and more neighborhoods.
I think we're going to see a lot of really interesting collaborations and business models. I just read something about how the old KFC and Taco Bell on DuBose is going to become a recording studio. Somebody's going to just going to build one there.
Yeah.
The space that I work with, that's a residency, is privately funded. You know, someone just decided to start it. I think that there will continue to be traditional organizations and more collaboration. And there's also going to be someone starting that thing in their garage that is going to turn out to be really cool. And we're all going to be amazed when they get to cross its path. But I think we'll see more of that, which I'm very happy to see, that there will be more people deciding to start things and maybe using traditional ways of doing it and maybe not.
Comments, questions, ideas?
Yeah, wait.
Okay, so I had a note, some offensive. Thank you, Beth. As I was teaching this, I was privy to about the RCE, which is a system in the East. Have I given this to a similar speak, like Krishki, Juice Paper, Bookology, you're all areas or seconds to show it is a right as well. And then, it's your desk, a lot of the keys are more buying, and that's time you see Chase coming in, and that's when you know. And then we saw a big fight. And so we're to the art breaky. What is the first be now? You see, but that wasn't just on the curves and those all waste trees. And now in summer cut there, cheer cream of jay. It things I saw sap, hot half. Some that's tried to add a timber. And the last partner is Jersey. In zona peaks, and you know, I do think that your traditions of the story should have been attacked. I think Sabbath, but you're that at this place, and we don't that this is not necessarily to be created, perhaps. But I then seen among the amazing bakers come out to Lippert with Sasak and other backwards in many occasions. So, I think that the memory right. Your Sammy sisters already done on RTD can find footing. Yeah, in just the new app. So.
Yeah. Years ago, they know the song, How Much Is This Doggy in the Widow? Then in 1990, the Toby Ness decided to come up and burn down the house. For the house, the deep window where the dog was. But Jermaine coined it, People's Case Chase, References Chase. Can start from the home and the education or the various of the kids to what's not the reporting that Pagarini play beautiful, you know, instrument that this put in sunlight all the way to whatever you mean in music. Okay, all the big bands were phenomenal. And then one day rock and rock came and rock and rock came, it was great. And then he disappeared and then rock came and then, you know, forward. So people state sage, references change, all the others come in 70. Together with real estate, when my nephews are dying to buy a home, they don't even live here. We live in another country. You look me all the big cities in the world. You manage San Francisco, Tel Aviv, New York, you know, Paris, London. You try to buy a house down Juliet. No, even if you're 30, 40, keep pieces here at all, it's difficult. But it's not only the art, it's everything to be. But as part of the preferences and all the other stuff, we look with people today that create art with digital stuff. And they will pick that we have the passion, we have the stuff, but we create painting to digital, or we create movies, or we create, you know, whatever it is. So, I don't know, I seem that it's hard to see.
I think the operative word in that is passion. That passion is what drives making. That's the modus operandi, because that's the very chemical process that drives all of us. The only thing we can count on, the only thing that we can really count on is change, because that's the only thing that is really going to be guaranteed, no matter how stale people try to make it right now. Anyway.
Any other comments or questions? Sorry, Kate.
Thank you, all of you, for that amazing talk.
I just wondered before we break up and go out and get something to eat and drink out there, if we could hear just a few words from Mitch about this show. Why did you do this?
There you go. Yeah. Okay. There you go. Part two, then you get it. Hey. I was trying to duck it. You guys are the three best people for me to duck behind and take responsibility for my work. Thank you, Kate. And thanks. Let's thank the folks here. I'm going to ask Cole and Julian, can you come out? And while I talk, we're going to put everyone on the spot, take a side each, and get some donations on the side. You are helping the DeRosa Foundation. I appreciated your comments about everything changes. And we are trying to build this organization to be a place that facilitates and showcases that change. This is a platform to reflect thoughtfully on how the culture is changing. They invite those people with those different modalities. And so that's what we're here to support tonight. And so really appreciate all of you being here, supporting it with your presence. So, I'll say this work, Dewey's always one of the voices in my mind as I do all my work. But this work is kind of one piece, and there's another person who, talked with Dewey. That's good friends with Griff. His name was Bill Berkson. Kate knew him very well, and he was a mentor and teacher of mine at the San Francisco Art Institute. And at one point, he gave me the advice, focus and do one thing. Just pick one thing. Limit your mind and just go to it and really dig in. And anything you feel or think or imagine or dream, put it up against that thing. Bend it. See what it does. See what it says. And so this body of work came to me as that kind of one thing. You'll see this kind of large totemic wave shape that is kind of an organizing principle, both in terms of composition as well as in terms of theme of a wave and what waves are and what are underneath those waves. And so all of these pieces have that limit to them. And then I injected a sense of chance operations. And what that was, what that looked like was I'd put six books out, I'd roll the dice, I'd pick, okay, three, I'm picking the book that was number three, I open it randomly, what photo is in there, and I'll start painting or drawing that as a prompt, okay? Anytime I got stuck, I'd have different stencils, I'd blindly put my hand in there, okay? There's this whole, in the art world, there's this list of oblique strategies to kind of free your mind. And what that is a way of trying to bend the consciousness that you're bringing to it against chance and chaos in a way that is not disorder, but it's a different order that opens up meaning. And the final frontier of meaning is audience. So many of these are my paintings of my consciousness at play, and all of that in $2 will get me on a bus, right? So these works aren't finished until tonight when you guys see them, right? Until you guys create meaning out of what you're seeing here, right? That's what art is. That's what it is. So in many ways, as those chance operations were an excuse, you know, for me to do these things, these things are an excuse for us to connect and find meaning together. There are 52 of them, like a deck of cards, like the weeks in the year and like the years. I was 52 when I kind of started the series. So they took place over about the last year. Okay. At the beginning of this conversation, I said I had some good news. Okay. There's always a surprise, right? There's always, you never know who's going to help you out with art. Okay. In my career, you might not know this. I don't know if my mom knows this. I have a career in medical malpractice. If you can put that together with these paintings, you're more creative than I am. Because I can't put it together, right? I have sat outside of that idea for a long time. And, you know, I don't even tell many people that I work with that I make art. There's Dan, of course. I'll tell Dan and Michelle. They know, but not many other people. And my boss, Allison, right there, said to me, "You're having an art show?" I said, "Yes." And she said,
I'd like to come. And I said, that would be lovely. And she said, I think we would like to sponsor the wine and food for the event. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, oh, yeah, I think that would be a good idea for our company to sponsor the wine and food for the event. And I thought to myself, you never know who is going to support an artist and how they're going to do it. So, Allison, I want to thank you. I say that in the spirit of all of us. Let's all be thankful. There are good people out there that will thank us out of the, that will be kind to us out of the blue. However challenging some of these dynamics are, this world is filled with beautiful people, and you guys are beautiful people who have supported this organization and this show. So we thank you very much and enjoy the open.